4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with us tomorrow. Coming up later, the appeal of guns in American culture and their potential for trouble. We'll meet the author of a new book on his experience with firearms. First, we're continuing our series of congressional candidate forums this afternoon. Before the news, we heard from one of the candidates running for Wisconsin's second congressional district seat. That was Republican Peter Theron. Now we turn to his Democratic opponent, incumbent Congressman Mark Pocan. He's a former state assembly representative, and he was elected to Congress in 2012 to represent the state's second congressional district. He joins us now in the studio. Congressman Pocan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rob. Glad to be here.
So why are you running for another term?
Well, you know, there's an awful lot that we have to get done. And unfortunately, the last 2 years have not been the most productive by any measure. You know, the legislative process is largely broken with the 2010 elections and the rise of the Tea Party. Really, 30 or 40 Tea Party people in the House hold all the rest of a sausage, Democrats and Republicans. And Speaker Boehner has allowed them to drive that agenda. And, you know, so we voted 54 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act this session. We've voted to sue the president, but we haven't got to the big issues that have to happen. You know, we have to raise the minimum wage. We have to help create an economy that helps to grow jobs. We need to make sure that more people have access to affordable health care. And those are all things that I did while I was in the legislature. I started to do in Congress, even though the legislative process isn't moving. And I'd like to continue to be able to do that for the people of South Central Wisconsin.
Well, with that gridlock and the reality that it's probably going to be a Republican-controlled House, possibly now a Republican-controlled Senate, what can you do in that situation to reach across the aisle and try to address at least some of those issues?
Well, you know, I've already been doing that with a group we have called a Problem Solver Caucus. It's basically people from both parties get together just to get to know each other kind of informally to find out what you might work on together. So it's not that we have necessarily an agenda, but we get together and you find out, kind of like I did in legislature, what you have in common rather than what you don't have in common, and you try to work on those things. And there's a lot we can do. Representative Reed Ribble from Wisconsin, a Republican, he and I have introduced a couple budget measures to try to reform the process. We're both on the budget committee, but we got to know each other, and once you get to know each other and you find out what you have in common, you can build on that. So there's a lot more activities like that I think we can continue to do and we should be doing, but also, you know, the rest of the job is still there. Even though the legislative process is broken, you know, we can work with the federal agencies. We help out a lot of constituents and a lot of different issues. And also, you know, I can use the congressional soapbox, so to speak, to talk about issues I think they're important and try to drive that agenda from the outside. So there's much that can still be done, and I'm hoping to do that in the next session.
Looking back at those 2 years in Congress, what do you point to as an achievement you're proud of? What do you wish you could have done differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what we've been able to get done for constituents probably is what stands out the most. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we were down in Beloit. There's a gentleman who served in the Korean War. He had been owed some medals, but his records were destroyed in a military fire in the 70s. They reached out to us as he's now in assisted living in his 80s, near the end of his life. We were able to do some work, and not only did we find out that he was owed 4 medals, but actually it turned out to be 6, and I had a chance to go down there and present it to him 62 or 63 years later. That's the kind of stuff that, you know, feels the best when you can actually help a real person in the district navigate federal government. Probably the thing that I don't know if I'd say I would do differently other than the thing I think that I was most disappointed on perhaps is how what we're doing right now going back into the Middle East. You know, the fact that we finally were hopefully leaving Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're getting back into that region where we really don't have a lot of BFFs. It's a very complex area, and I don't know if what we're doing again is right. It's something that I disagree with the president on, and I think that those are some of us in Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, that were very skeptical and still are of what direction we're going.
Well, I know there are a lot of unintended consequences on getting involved, but there are consequences in not getting involved. Do you worry about what happens if ISIS is given free rein in Iraq, Syria, beyond?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think the most important thing is that we have a coalition of partners in the region, because if we try to lead another effort down there and we haven't been successful what we did in Iraq and we haven't been successful in other measures over history in that region, we're going to have the history repeat itself. So instead, we have to get people on the ground from the region, because the region is what's most affected by ISIS. There's no question it's a serious, it's a terrorist organization. They have resources. But when the best we can do for on the ground help is the Iraqi army that ran once from ISIS and potentially the Turkey army, although they want a real plan plan and we haven't quite laid that out tells me we've got more work to do in order to do it right. And I don't know if arming moderate rebels, in some cases they're Muslim Brotherhood, in some cases they're fighting Assad, in some cases they're just defending their town, in some cases they're the ones that sold the second journalist Sotloff to ISIS. It's a very mixed area, and to think that we're going to go in there and that's going to be the magic silver bullet just didn't fly from the briefings I attended.
Well, turning to domestic issues, pretty much every election we're talking about jobs and the economy loom very large. What role do you think Congress could play in spurring job creation in Wisconsin and beyond?
Well, I always think of three things when I look at the economy and jobs. One, we should invest in education because that's how people can better their lives and hopefully get a better paying job and support their families in a better way. The second is, I think, for our country, investing in research and development. We've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs over the years thanks to what I consider bad trade deals done by both Democrats and Republicans. I'm currently fighting the biggest and the baddest, the most current one, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But if we invest in the jobs that we do have here in research and development, that's a smart investment. And finally, investing in our infrastructure. You know, we have a large number of bridges and roads in that are old enough that'd be eligible for Medicare. You can put people immediately back to work. You can help build that infrastructure. Those are three pillars, I think, that you can go to advancing the economy and creating jobs.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that the president deserves some blame for the economic recovery from the recession not being as fast as it could?
Well, you know, I think part of the problem is Congress and states were doing everything they could to not help. So while we were seeing job increases in the private sector, we actually saw decreases in the public sector. And we've been fighting a Congress that has been pretty unwilling to work with this president. So, you know, I think he's been a bit handcuffed in trying to have the recovery, but we're having a recovery. Things are coming back. I think the one thing that's worthy of note is that the number of chronically unemployed people is growing. So we are noticing that some people are getting left behind. And I think we have to have special efforts to make sure that those who are getting left behind somehow get included in the economy, or else they're going to be a drain in other ways on the economy that's not good for everyone.
Are there any issues you see as particularly important for the 2nd District here in Wisconsin?
You know, I think any of the issues nationally, they come back, you know, jobs in the economy, et cetera. But I think one that I've put a lot of time into since I serve on the Education and Workforce Committee is on higher education affordability. We have 75,000 higher education students in the 2nd Congressional District, one of the highest in the country. And the fact that we've been trying to lead on some efforts, and we did have the very first bill in Congress to allow students to be able to refinance their loans, much like you do a home or a car. You can't really do with loans right now. There's a few ways through consolidation, but there's not many. That's one of the things we try to focus on. We're trying to figure out ways to make higher education more affordable, and we've asked Secretary Duncan when he's been before the committee to help come up with some ideas how we could incentivize states to put money back in, because let's face it, not only have most states since the crash of 2008 not put money back in their public school system, but in Wisconsin, we've been really remiss, and Scott Walker's done, I think, a really bad job, and it could hurt the university system. So those are some of the things that I think really relate back to the 2nd Congressional District that I work on a very regular basis on.
Let's turn to the budget. Ongoing concerns about a growing national debt. While annual deficits have gone down a little, the debt keeps growing. What policies would you like to see to get the budget on track and maybe reduce that overall debt?
Sure. Well, first, deficits have gone down quite a bit, about 60% under President Obama. So we've had some significant reduction. Now, granted, most of that is because we've had people returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and some things that were pretty high-level dollar expenses going down. But I still think there's more we could do around saving money in the defense area, that we can get wiser and smarter as we're trying to get into a world where we don't have a lot of conflicts. There's things we can do when it comes to tax policy. We still provide subsidies for oil and gas companies, some of the most profitable companies in the world. We provide tax credits for companies to send jobs overseas. We provide tax credits for corporate jets. There's a lot of tax reform we could do as well. So I think there's a lot of areas. The biggest problem I think we've had is we haven't really got budgets done lately. We've had a couple just very recently, but even then we didn't finish the appropriations process. Again, since 2010, we've kind of done continuing resolutions. We kick the can a few months down the road, but that allows for no planning for anyone. And if you don't have a real budget process in place, you're never going to get to actually reducing the debt or really reducing the deficit like you'd like to. And that's part of why Representative Reed Ribble and I have a bill to try to change the budget process. Instead of an annual budget process, we'd like to see it a biennial process like you have in Wisconsin and most states. One year we'll do the budget. One year we'll do serious review and analysis. We think it's a smarter, more balanced approach to it. We have over 150 bipartisan sponsors on that. We got a bipartisan vote out of the Budget Committee, and we're hoping that we'll still, hopefully, with the year, be able to get it through the House and try to get that done.
We're talking right now with Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan. He's up for re-election in Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He faces challenger Republican Peter Theron in next week's election. Right now, we're hosting a candidate forum with Congressman Mark Pocan. He's the Democratic incumbent candidate running for Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District seat. If you have a question for him, or if you want to run an issue by him, see what he thinks, call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, immigration policy is something that went back and forth. The House had some plans. The Senate, the Democrats there had other plans. Nothing ultimately resolved. So what would you like to see happen when it comes to immigration?
Well, you know, what happened is the Senate does things differently than the House. Because of the closure rule, they actually work in a bipartisan way, unlike the House has. So a gang of eight, you have gangs of, they refer to them when they get these bipartisan groups, came up with a plan, a bipartisan plan. It got a bipartisan vote out of the Senate. And while it's not perfect, I'm in general very supportive of that plan because that's most likely to become law. Unfortunately, in the House, all they really want to do is part of the plan. They want to build the big, big fence, but they don't want to do anything about path to citizenship for people who've been here literally their entire life. So I just think the Senate plan is a smarter plan because it was, one, done in the right way, in a bipartisan way to begin with, but two, the House hasn't passed anything. And until we pass something, you can't get to conference committee where you can resolve the differences and have a final law in place. Doing nothing is a continuation of what we've been doing with a broken immigration system, and unfortunately, that's been the position under the House Republicans.
But what in particular would you like to see the end result be?
Well, I think, you know, making sure that we have the secure, the resources and the secure parts of the border that are needed, but also making sure we really have a path to citizenship for those aspiring Americans who want it. I've talked to more people that I run into right here in the district who've been here in the United States since they're like 5 months old. They're not going to college, but because they weren't born here, they don't have that citizenship path, and we need to make sure there is a path for people like that. I mean, to send someone back to whatever home country when they've been here since they're 5 months old is rather ridiculous, and we need to have a clear, concrete plan. Right now, deporting some family members is, I think, cruel to those families when you're doing it in pieces. So we just need to have something that's comprehensive, that's difficult enough to make sure there's a real path to citizenship, but there's a path nonetheless, but also that incorporates the security that all other people want. But that's a package that, much like the Senate's done, and that's what I think we need to focus on.
Now, as we heard from your challenger, his top priority is repealing the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned votes in the House to do just that. I'm assuming you're opposed to out and out repeal, but are there changes you would like to see made?
You know, I think we always have to be open to improve any law, and same would be true of the Affordable Care Act. The difference from what I think some people talk about the Affordable Care Act and maybe the reality of the Affordable Care Act is we now have 8 million people who've signed up for the Affordable Care Act, which exceeded the goals they originally laid out. We have 3 million people now who stay on their parents' policies until they're 26. We have 5 million people now that have access to expanded Medicare in states that did that. Unfortunately, Wisconsin and Governor Scott Walker chose not to do that for our citizens. So we have about 15 million people who now have access to health care that never did before. If you have a pre-existing condition, you can't be turned down now. You have access to health care. So I don't like to govern by anecdote, but I've had people call my office literally crying, saying for the first time ever they've been able to get health insurance. Now, if there are parts that have to be fixed, it would be foolish to not say you'd try to do that, and there's still parts that have to be implemented, but I keep hearing about some of the problems that they talk about with, you know, employer hours and things like that, and that part of the law hasn't been implemented yet. So it's impossible for there to be problems that have created out of that, but I've been hearing that for the last year. So if we see something that needs to be adjusted because it wasn't thought of properly when it was put together, of course we need to change that. But right now we're having most of the successes that they promised through the law have happened, and albeit for the initial rollout, I don't know if I want the federal government putting websites together anymore, but everything else I think has come together pretty well with the law.
Now, how about the long-term future of programs like Medicare and Social Security? These are things we keep coming back to year after year, decade after decade, really. Are there changes you'd consider to those programs to keep them healthy into the future?
Well, you know, those are two programs that, one, are two of the most popular programs we have in government, and two, they're really a promise from the federal government that we've paid into all of our life. It comes out of your paycheck, you're paying in as well as your employer are paying in, and you should have that promise available when you need it. So when you're ready to retire, if you should become disabled, if, God forbid, your, you know, parent dies, you want that available for the child. And I think rather than kind of cut benefits, like the Republicans have proposed through the chain CPI, or privatizing it and putting it in the hands of Wall Street banks, because we've seen what's happened when we've done that. What makes the most sense to me is to lift the salary cap for what we how we raise money for Social Security. So right now, somewhere around $115,000, give or take a couple thousand, you quit paying when you get paid that amount, you quit paying into Social Security. And that doesn't make a lot of sense. So it doesn't track how we do all of our other taxes. If you lifted that cap, and if you make $250,000, you continue to pay that same rate all the way up to $250,000, you're not stopped at that $115 level, you would extend the life of Social Security for 75 years into the future. To me, that makes a lot more sense rather than cutting benefits to people who really need it. Because my mom's 85. She gets $1,101 a month. I've gone through her bills on the floor of Congress, $1,186 they came to a month, and that's only because she owns the home and she owns her car from the 90s. For anyone else, to cut that benefit would be really difficult, and most of our senior citizens, 20 to 30% of their income is spent on medicine, which is much more than the rest of us in society, and that's some of the fastest cost increases. So, again, I would do things to extend the life of the fund like that rather than cutting benefits.
Do you see some kind of reforms along those lines as a possibility in at least a partially Republican-controlled Congress?
Well, you know, I think just if we could have the opportunity to sit down and talk about where their priorities are and talk to people of America and find out where their priorities are, I don't think they're going to want to see us cut the program. I think the support might be closer to where I'm talking about, is lifting that cap so people who make more also pay into it. But, you know, we may have to look at other things, but that's part of how you negotiate, right? You sit down, you actually have a conversation, and you figure out how to get something done. Unfortunately, this current Congress, under Speaker Boehner, allowing the Tea Party tail to wag the Republican Party dog, has made it very difficult for us to get anything on the floor, which is why I think we voted 54 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act rather than dealing with Social Security or immigration or raising the minimum wage.
Kind of an abstract governance question. Sometimes we have a conflict between wanting to tackle a problem and hit everything at once, immigration. The Affordable Care Act would be an example of that versus, no, let's take it one at a time. Immigration, let's do border security, then path to citizenship. Do you have thoughts? Should we do these grand bargains, another one with the budget, or try to hit it a little bit at a time?
Yeah, I think when you have divided government, which is, you know, most of the time I've been around, it's rare you have all the Republicans in charge or all the Democrats in charge. That means you have to compromise, right? So you're going to have to sit down and figure out that. So that's how you initially sit down. That's why often I find packages come together a little better, because in general, and this is generalizing, the Democrats have been more out there on a path to citizenship. The Republicans probably have been a little more out there on border security. But that's how you then craft that compromise that gets a little bit of everything to get everything done, rather than not talking to each other, which is what we do right now. So I think that often just is how to best get it done. And you have to remember, everyone has to leave with a little bit of a win. You know, you're going to have government that changes like a pendulum, and you have to be able to talk to others to get something done.
Well, I want to run an issue past you that's in the news a lot today. We've been hearing from a lot of members of Congress, including on this show, on Ebola and the federal government response to it. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think that some of the things I've seen make me a bit nervous, because I think they're in the reactionary mode rather than the thoughtful mode. I would like us to go to medical professionals and get expertise from them. I think what just happened in New York and New Jersey, this quarantine on any doctor for 21 days, to me, potentially has some real pitfalls, because you're going to have fewer volunteers going to Doctors Without Borders, who do a tremendous job in helping people across the world with Ebola and other diseases. But if after 3 or 4 weeks of service, they have to come back and give up another 3 weeks, that could be a problem. At the same time, we want to make sure we've got checks and balances in place so you don't have it spreading. So I think that medical professionals, we need to rely on a lot more than we have. When people were talking about bans on flights and there were no direct flights in the U.S. and they didn't know that, that just showed where some of the ignorance of the debates was happening. But I think the CDC has learned from some of our initial steps. I think a big one was getting us to the point of using those 4 facilities that are out there that are experts, rather than having every hospital be an expert.
Mm-hmm. And that's maybe part of the reason for that reaction you're talking about, was from the initial words from the CDC saying, in effect, any hospital can handle this.
Right.
Seeing to the contrary. So do you think there needs to be more review of the CDC's initial reaction?
Well, and exactly. And I think they've evolved fairly quickly when they realize they've made a mistake. And I think that was one that stood out, and I'm glad that we've moved from. But to think that, you know, every single hospital in South Central Wisconsin has to be prepared is probably not realistic. I've been to many of the hospitals, and we have a lot of rural critical access hospitals. and others that just aren't going to be equipped. But we have facilities that are very well equipped, and let's use those wisely and properly. And but it's also, let's make sure we're not creating such hype and hyperbole that we wind up making other bad decisions around the disease.
We'll leave it there for now. Congressman Pocan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, thank you.
That was Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan. He's up for re-election in Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. His opponent is Republican Peter Theron. We talked to him earlier in the show. If you missed that or any of our forums from last week, head over to wisconsinvote.org. You'll find the audio from all of our candidate forums and those for the Joy Cardine Show as well, by the way. And you'll get the lineup of interviews still to come.